Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Susan Sager talks about being young and stupid in Hollywood.
First of all, he goes, I live at blah, 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 you know, Crescent Heights about. And I'm like, I mean, I'm meeting you at your apartment. Okay, that's the number one thing every actress in Hollywood is, never go to a casting director or director's apartment. Do you think I heeded that warning? I did not. And I thought, okay, I'm going to put the black, you know, leotard on with fishnets, my 6-inch green glitter heels back from the, you know, glitter rock days, you know, and that's how I'm going to the audition.
Today on the show, comedian Susan Sager talks about how she got cast to play Doris the Dominatrix in the cult classic Eating Raoul. Stay close.
Hey, it's Susan Sager, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Hey! Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. I have to say, if you're a new listener, you've got some catching up to do, because I'm celebrating 9 years in July. Yay. And it's like 560 shows, something like that. So lots going on, you guys, lots of great stories, and you're going to hear a great one today. Now, listen, I don't know if you heard last week's story with writer and creator of That 70s Show, Mark Brazil, but that guy has a lot to say. Did you hear that episode by any chance?
I have not, not yet.
Actually, I think it just dropped today. That's probably why you didn't hear it, but Mark talks about writing on a deadline. And he is so damn funny. It's a really good episode. He's trying to write. He's got like 3 days to complete the script, and there's a rat in the house, and there's a girl in a bikini, and it just gets super funny and super crazy. Next thing you know, he's on a horse farm, and there's a gun and a bear, and Mark Brazil is hilarious. So go back, you guys, and listen to him. But not today, because I'm here today with actress and comedian Susan Sager, and she brings forth the topic, young and stupid in Hollywood.
Yes.
Young and stupid in Hollywood. Sometimes, you know what, I swear to God, Susan, I am so glad I didn't get out here till I was 31. Because I feel like had I come at 18, 22, 25.
Yeah, 24 when I got here.
I feel like I might have messed up pretty badly, you know?
I don't know.
Well,
you go, there you are.
Yeah,
whatever,
I guess so.
You know, decade it is, I think, you know.
Yeah.
They've all got their challenges.
I know what you're saying. And I could say like young and stupid as a flight attendant, because I was a flight attendant when I was young.
I'm sure.
So, you know, I'm sure. Well, I know I did a lot of stupid things. So I guess it depends on where you are. But it's just Hollywood is so, you know, iconic and has such a reputation of being like a dog-eat-dog world. You know,
right.
And there's always somebody younger, and there's always somebody more beautiful.
Hotter.
And there's just, you know, it's not just beautiful people. It's like the homecoming queen of every high school in the world is here.
And they get a rude awakening, don't they?
And often they do.
Often they do.
Yeah. Now, sometimes people, you know, I don't know, it seems like their careers go on a straight trajectory, but that's probably not true.
Some, I think you're right. Some do. It's just the luck of the draw. There's no formula. There's no do this, 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 and this, and that will happen.
Yeah.
It is, and that's what makes it, you know, exciting and challenging. And those of us that are adventure junkies like yourself, that's why we do it.
Yeah. It is funny. It's not like, you know, if you want to be a doctor, yes, it's going to take a whole lot of your life, and it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to cost a lot of money.
Right.
But you'll be a doctor.
Right.
If you would like to be a movie star, well,
you know, take the same amount of time, probably just as much money and classes, vocal training, on camera, you know, study, all that stuff. And then maybe you will, maybe you won't. Chances are what, 99.8% that you won't?
Yeah,
is
so
that what it is?
Like in the Screen Actors Guild, I think it's now called SAG-AFTRA. In SAG-AFTRA, how many people are not working?
They say, I think 6% of membership actually makes their living 100% from the entertainment industry.
And gets insurance that way.
Right.
Most people do not.
No. The other 94%, not so much.
You know what's hard about that thing is, like, some years I will, you know, qualify for insurance, but then other years I won't.
Right.
So it's very inconsistent.
Yeah.
So you're changing doctors and changing your whole health thing.
I have a good story about that, but it has nothing to do with this.
Why? What?
Well, I was on a TV show, and I got AFTRA insurance. This was in the early 90s. It was called Totally Hidden Video.
Sure.
Where we pranked on people. So you'd stay off camera and do your thing and then not get noticed as much. So I got pregnant, and I had Blue Cross Prudent Buyer, and it didn't cover pregnancy unless there was an emergency.
Blue Cross Prudent Buyer.
That's what this is. 1990.
Okay.
So I got this job and got pregnant in the meantime, and I'm 10 months, no, not 10 months, 8 months pregnant. It's October. The baby's due in December. And after insurance kicked in, they didn't consider pregnancy a pre-existing condition, and they covered me.
Wow.
And I already had this other insurance that didn't cover pregnancy, so I got a discount for prepaying the hospital. You know, then there was an emergency C. Everybody paid me. I made $7,000. I swear to God.
Is that
having
true?
A baby. Yes. And I
that
called.
Is so
I know,
funny.
I called my insurance company. And I said, wait a minute. First of all, pregnancy is one of the most pre-existing conditions. But aside from that, I know. The woman looked at me. I said, you know, I'm a single mom. And she goes, honey, you earned it. Cash the check.
Wow.
I know.
That is a really funny story. I've never heard of all the insurance companies paying.
So that's what happens when you keep them all.
Yeah. See, usually you have to.
But I was being honest.
Yeah. That's really funny. So you've seen a lot out here in Hollywood, Susan, because you got here when you were, 24 years old.
1979.
And so you've seen all sorts of things come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And does the struggle ever end?
Yes, it does. Only the internal struggle is the thing. You know, when I came out here, I had stars in my eyes, 1979. It was my first job in L.A. was as a waitress at the Comedy Store.
Yeah, I knew that.
On Sunset, yeah. Oh, my God. It was like going to college, you know, all
over
again.
But you weren't allowed to be a stand-up at the time, right?
No. Because I was an improvisational actress. And on Monday and Tuesday nights in Hollywood in the main room and Sunday nights in Westwood, there was a big improv show. And the headliners were the Comedy Store Players, starring Robin Williams.
Wow.
And Marty Short was in it, Bernadette Briquette, a lot of people.
But I'm saying, but as a waitress at the Comedy Store, didn't they not allow people?
I had to quit my job to start performing.
Wow.
Now, if you were a doorman or, you know, were a male doing other things, they did not have to quit.
Is that complete bullshit or what?
Well,
what is that?
Yeah, I mean... get me. This isn't a Me Too show. We'll do another one.
Well,
of those.
No, but that's such an incredible.
But that's how it was. You know what?
I know, but even though it was being run by a female, Mitzi Shore,
and who did not like women.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
Susan, I don't think you're very funny.
Yeah, she didn't like women. That's so true. I mean, I know that they say that she created the belly room for women,
right? To get them out of the main room where her guys were.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I don't know what that is with female bookers, but there's something about female bookers that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying in all cases, but a couple of other clubs is like that, are like that too, where the female booker has this resentment toward the female comedian because I don't know if they want to be a comedian or they're jealous or envious.
I think it was young Jewish girl reminded her of self at said age and couldn't stand that. So hence she couldn't stand me.
Interesting.
And I just kept my head down, you know, and stayed out of her way and did a really good job, you know, as a waitress so that... And then Meg Stahl was there at the time, and she was the one running the improvisers. So on Monday night, Andy Kaufman would come in and wrestle women after the show.
Oh, wow.
It was wild. It was
I bet.
And people were lined around the block, you know, on Sunset to get in on a Monday and Tuesday night. Crazy. Main room. Packed.
It's still packed. I mean, that club is on fire.
It wasn't really for a while. For a few years, there was like,
I know, but
it kind of hurt my heart.
I'm just saying, again, now
that's good.
The Comedy Store, all comedy clubs seem to be really doing well.
Well, people
right now
are kind of not real happy, so they need to laugh. I just got back from Vegas with the Jennifer Valley last week, and that people really want to laugh, you know?
They want to escape.
And not divisively, however.
Yeah.
I was just trying to sound intelligent.
No, I know what you're saying.
But, you know, but... people need to laugh.
Yeah, because of politics and the country and the, yeah. so much sadness.
Yeah. But in those days, to get back to the point, Robin Williams was king of everything except for Howard Stern was king of all media then.
Yeah.
But he was one of the most unbelievable improvisers. I took class in the day as a waitress, started working. Are we starting on the story?
No,
we,
huh?
Oh, no. Then we'll get to it. But this was how, you know, I started performing there, which will lead up to the story.
Okay.
You know, and it was, I left my apartment that I shared with another waitress from the Comedy Store who I met working at the Comedy Store. I mean, it was a really tight community.
Totally.
Yeah, back then. And I just left the door and I said, I'm not coming back till I have another job.
Wow.
Period.
Wow.
And I came back with three. So I quit my job at the Comedy Store.
What were the other jobs?
Let's see. One was Cafe Figaro on Melrose, I ended up working for 7 years.
Yeah.
And the other was Cantor's, which I just thought was hilarious.
The deli.
And yeah. And could I really wear one of those outfits and how funny would that be? But then on second thought, I went, not so funny.
What were the outfits?
You know, those old-time lady waitress, like Flo from the diner.
Oh,
you know?
I see. Yeah, Cantor says like
yeah, with the white shoes, yeah.
Diner, I couldn't, Alice.
Yeah,
whatever.
I was 25. No, yeah. That wasn't happening. And as a waitress at the Improv. So I took both jobs, waitress at the Improv.
So
and
the Comedy Store knew that you were waitressing at the Improv
No,
as
I didn't
well?
Tell them.
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, I didn't say anything.
It's still, you know, it's no. such a kind of a rival thing going
on. Oh,
yeah,
on you couldn't perform at one and the other.
Do you have a lot? I'm just asking, and we'll get right to your story in a second, but do you have? Do you still have friends here in Los Angeles that you had back then, or have a lot of people left?
Yeah.
Yes, what?
Sure. Yes, I do. And some of them have done, you know, extremely well.
Yeah.
Some of them have, moved on. Bryan Cranston and I used to work together doing Equity Waiver Theater.
They say he's a great guy.
I've
heard all good things about him.
Yeah. Andy Garcia was in one of the groups at the Comedy Store. I mean, there were so many people that came through there.
Yeah.
And then a lot, like Dan Frischman, I'm still really, you know, in touch with. He just turned 60. And
He's been on the show,
Dan
Frischman.
I know.
And he came to my one-woman show, which was very kind of
nice.
Him. Yeah, it's really interesting how, in a way, this town is so large and seems out of reach. But then at the same time, with time, with a couple of decades under your belt, now all of a sudden it's sort of a smaller town.
Right.
You know, it really, it seems when I meet somebody I've never met before and they're completely in my world, as it were, I'm surprised.
Yeah. That happens to me all the time at stand-up shows.
Still.
Yeah. It's like, I never heard of this comic and they're working all the time. Yeah.
And you're not talking about 22-year-olds. You're talking about like a 40-year-old shows up and,
right.
Wow, I've never even heard of you.
Who was that? Yeah.
It's the craziest
thing,
man.
There's so many markets.
So listen, time goes on. Decades go by, and now you're about to be a grandmother.
Yes.
Which is super fun.
Super fun.
And you also have three children.
I have three children.
And I have a child. Well, check this out. You know what a subscription box is, right?
Uh-huh.
Because they've got them for like food, they've got them for wellness. Well, now they've got them for kids.
Oh.
And these boxes are fun and educational, and it helps them develop creative confidence to literally change the world. Oh. There, I said it. I said it, Susan Sager.
What age group?
Our kids are the future, damn it.
Yes.
Well, check this out. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids to make learning about STEAM fun. You know what STEAM stands for?
No.
Susan, yes, you do.
What?
Science. Come on, help
science,
me out.
Science.
Technology.
Engineering.
Art and math. And these projects are designed by experts and tested by kids. And there's no need to research or worry about gathering all the supplies because everything is right there in the box.
That's nice.
And back to what you were talking about, different ages. There are 7 lines to choose from for kids of all ages, 0 to 16. And even some of the projects, like I would like to do. I'm not kidding you. there's different boxes. One is called the Tadpole Crate. And this is for children that are 0 to 2. And they deliver age-appropriate hands-on projects to help infants and toddlers build a foundation for learning. But now they go all the way up, right? The Koala Crate is for kids from ages 3 to 4. Then there's the Kiwi Crate, the Atlas Crate, the Doodle Crate, and my daughter got the Tinker Crate. And that helps young innovators discover and learn about science. And this is good for my child because she's never been a huge science person. But KiwiCo makes it interesting and fun. And I got to tell you, as a parent, you know, obviously we're busy, we're on the go, and it can be tough to do all these things with your kid. But now, you know, this box comes in the mail and you can work together with your child to create an engaging and exciting project. So you guys, check out KiwiCo. It is convenient and it is an affordable way to encourage your children to be anything they want to be. And for my listeners, if you go to kiwico.com/storyworthy, you'll get your first month free. You guys, every day, yeah, I know, right? Every day counts when it comes to making a difference, so don't miss out on this amazing opportunity. Again, go to kiwico.com/storyworthy and you'll get your first month free. That's kiwico.com. I'm going to spell it because I'm a giver. KIWICO.com/storyworthy and you'll get your first month free. This is a great gift, not only if you have children, but like for your grandchildren. So if you know somebody having a baby or a shower gift or whatever, you guys check it out. KiwiCo.com/storyworthy. Now listen, before we get to Susan's story, I did want to remind you guys to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at storyworthy. Susan Sager, I noticed you're over there at those places at Susan Sager.
Yes.
Aren't you lucky to get that name?
Who wants it? Actually,
no, I'm serious.
Actually, I have a story. Somebody had the name Susan Sager, S-A-G-E-R, and I'm S-A-I-G-E-R.
Right.
She complained to SAG about me. The reason she complained was she would go on my auditions and they'd go, "You're not Susan Sager."
You're not the one we're looking for. That is hilarious.
I mean, she benefited from it. So anyway, so she tried to get me to add a middle initial or whatever, and I'm like, nah, and I won the case.
It's good,
like,
for you.
I had too many credits that were already in that name. There was no way I could change
good
it.
Good for you. Good for you, because sometimes people have to write, like, the real Susan Sager.
It wasn't her name.
Or that Susan
her
Sager.
Name
it
was
never her name.
An anagram of S-A-G-E-R. So it wasn't even her name.
I hate her. There.
Good.
I said it.
Thank you.
And you guys,
that's what girlfriends do.
Check out my other show, screwedupstories.com. You should be on that show too, Susan. Okay. You really should. And that show I co-host with comedian Rachel O'Brien. We have such a good time. All different generations of women telling screwed up stories, because, you know, at the end of the day, it turns out we all screw up the same way.
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's so fun. Anyway, you guys, also, please, if you get a chance, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a good review. I haven't asked you to do this in a long time, but for some reason, it's important. Therefore, if you do it for me, I will be very, very grateful. Thank you. All right, you guys, she's here right now, Susan Sager. She is an actress and a comedian who, like you said, began your working career in Hollywood as a waitress at the Comedy Store. And I find that also fascinating, because what a great way to get a quick look at what is going on.
Unbelievable. Because everybody went out in those days.
Yeah.
There was no internet.
Yeah.
You couldn't watch stuff, you know, on your television. There was
you had to leave your home.
You had to leave your home to see entertainment, and the casting people were out every night.
Yeah.
And agents, and, you know,
I mean, that's how they would see talent. They'd sit in the back of the comedy store and watch what's going on.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
Obviously. You've also performed comedy now all over the country. I don't have to tell you.
No.
And you're frequently in Las Vegas. And what I find also super fascinating about you is early on in your career, you were cast in the cult classic Eating Raoul, playing five different roles.
Yes.
It was such a funny time back then, in terms of the filmmaking was so much more avant-garde. And maybe specifically this film. It was like,
it was specifically this film. And, you know, that's the funny thing is... it was my first audition.
Wow.
I didn't have an agent.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't have any credits, but what I did have was my union card, because I had been doing dinner theater.
Oh, interesting.
For a year, right out of college, I got on the beef and board circuit.
And what's that mean?
Beef and boards. And board. It was like, you know, whatever comedy chains are going on now. It was a dinner theater circuit.
I see.
And I got my equity card, and I worked with Bobby Morse, who was in everything, How to Succeed in Business. He played True on Broadway. He was in da da da, and we did Play It Again, Sam by Woody Allen.
Yeah,
and I got in because I was a hustler. I went. The girl that was playing the second lead got pregnant and couldn't go on. And I go, I can learn it here. You don't have to rehearse me. Blah 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 blah. And so I got my union card. So when I came to LA, the first thing I did was buy my SAG card, which at that time, had you been working in a union for a year, was half price.
Oh my gosh.
I got my SAG card in 1979 for $300.
That is so
interesting. I know.
Interesting.
I came here with $400 and three suitcases, and I spent $300 to get my card.
Well, it ended up in your favor, for sure.
I wanted that hurdle you know, amazing. Over with. Because it's like a catch-22 to try to get, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Because you have to be union to work union. You right. have to, how and do I you had, get in the union if you can't work? It's all so right. convoluted.
And I had done little TV shows and stuff in Cincinnati. I played a dancing record in a commercial. You know, everything that actors.
A dancing record.
A dancing
That's
record.
That's hilarious.
You can trade it in for cash at anybody's. Oh, God, it was horrible.
Well, I'm excited to hear your story. And I definitely want to talk more about eating Raul. You guys, like we said, you can find Susan over there on Instagram and Twitter. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Susan Sager.
Woo! She's Yay. Here. Yay! Okay, so I had, as I told you, I was performing. I mean, I was waitressing at the Comedy Store, and Meg Stahl, who was the person who was directing the improv classes, which we all took during the day, and Andy Garcia was in the, I mean, it was a who's who of a lot of the comics tried their hand at improvising, and there was a real shortage of women. So if you were a woman and you were any good at all, you got noticed. And so Meg said, after like 4 or 5 months, she goes, I need you to quit your job. I want you on stage. I want you in the show. So I was like, you don't have to ask me twice. And I went out that day, like I said earlier, and got another job, got that. So I started performing on Labor Day weekend of, I think it was 1980. I had been waitressing there a year, maybe 81. And I was in the Potluck Players, which is the, you know, low guys on the totem pole. And whoever, if you signed up and got lucky enough, you could go on as an improviser. And there was like 15 people on stage. And we did all the, you know, regular games and whatnot. So I did that a while. Made some, that's where I met Dan Frischman. He became my writing partner. Fred Goss, who went on to direct a bunch of television. And, you know, Andy Garcia, who, you know, nominated for Academy Award. Everybody was, you know, all there for a common purpose of, you know, trying to learn improv and do it and perform it. And we'd go at night and watch Robin Williams and sneak in the ones that were under 21 so they could watch too. And so I had graduated to the second group above Potluck Players, which was called Side Two. We were so cool. Okay, we thought we were so cool. It's like, oh yeah, like side one of an album, which don't even exist anymore, is never the good side. It's always side two. You know, so that was, and Adam Small was in that group who went on to create Mad TV. And I mean, there's just, anyway. So one night I was performing, and I did a lot of characters. That was my thing, and I always had a bag of different sunglasses or scarves so that in a second's notice I could, you know, whatever, you know, change completely. And after this show one night, this guy who was the assistant director on Eating Raul had been in the audience because his name was Peter. I can't remember his last name because his girlfriend was a waitress. And so I'd known him casually from him picking her up and all that stuff. So he happened to be the AD on Eating Raul, and Betty Thomas was supposed to play Doris the Dominatrix. Everybody, you know, Betty Thomas, she was the big blonde cop on Hill Street Blues. She's directed numerous films. She's a great actress, so funny. She was in an improv group with Gil Christner and I think Henan Chambers, called Griffith Park Observatory. And they were right after us. Well, Peter had come in to see her. And she had let them know like 2 days before that she had to back out. She couldn't play Doris. She was cast to play this role because they were shooting exteriors in San Francisco the first weekend that Doris was supposed to shoot. And I mean, this movie was done on no money. They kept waiting for money to come in. They hawked Paul Bartel's parents, hawked their house. I mean, it was just drips and drabs. Anyway, she couldn't do it. They had 3 days to replace her. Peter walked in, saw me that night on comedy, you know, on the Comedy Store stage and went, "That girl." And the next day, I gave him my number. And I, you know, he told me what the lowdown was. And the next day, I got a call from Paul Bartel saying, "I heard wonderful things about you, and I have this role of, you know, she plays 5 different characters, so I need somebody, da, da, da. Can you come read?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I think I'm free. You know, I think I can make it." "Today, can you come?" You know, and so I was like, "Yeah, sure." So after my, you know, shift or whatever that day, I went home and I thought, and he kind of explained to me who she was. She was a dominatrix by night, but a homemaker by day and had a kid and was a very, you know, well-adjusted kind of woman. She just happened to do this and that she put all this stuff on. So, okay. So I thought, how am I going to... Now, mind you, I had no agent, no representation, never had a movie audition in my life. Okay, I had taken some camera technique classes, so I had a little bit of knowledge as to what to do. But I thought, how am I going to get noticed? Oh, okay, well, first of all, he goes, I live at blah, 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 you know, Crescent Heights and Fountain. I'm like, I mean, I'm meeting you at your apartment. Okay, that's the number one thing every actress in Hollywood is, never go to a casting director or director's apartment. Do you think I heeded that warning? I did not. And I thought, how am I going to get noticed? Okay, so I don't know if you remember because you're way younger than me. There used to be these dance skin outfits. They were like leotards, kind of shiny, usually a wrap top and then a wrap skirt, right?
Like a Jane Fonda.
Yes, exactly. That's the look. That's the 80s look. Okay, so I had a bunch of those from a waitress job I had in Cincinnati. And I thought, okay, I'm going to put the black, you know, leotard on with fishnets, my 6-inch green glitter heels back from the, you know, glitter rock days, you know, and I'm going to, that's how I'm going to the audition. I'm going to go a little heavy on the makeup and I'm just going to look like this ominous thing. Meanwhile, I'm 5'2", 110 pounds, you know, long dark hair, the total opposite of Betty, you know, and but I thought, you know what? I have nothing to lose. You know, they asked for me. I'm going to go. I mean, I was excited and everything. So I go over to Paul Bartel's apartment like a ninny, ninny, ninny. You know what could have happened. I could have been in slave trade to this day. But so girls out there, do not ever do, don't do what I did. But anyway, I go to his apartment and he answered the door and he just took one look at me and kind of started laughing because I was this tiny little thing trying to be so tough. And I took the tie on the skirt and just let my skirt fall to the ground. So there I was in all the, you know, fishnets and the green glitter. And I stuck my hand straight out and I went, Susan Sager. And he couldn't stop laughing. He just couldn't stop laughing. He couldn't believe that I did that. And actually, neither can I. And then so we went in his living room and, you know, it wasn't creepy or weird. There were scripts and pictures and storyboards and stuff everywhere because they had no main office. I mean, it was done for $500,000, this movie. And anyway, so he just kept throwing pages of script at me. And I would pick a different character that I happened to be doing at the Comedy Store and just throw it into whatever I was reading so that it he could get some kind of variety. And I got home and, you know, we shook hands and he said, I'll call you.
Was there anybody else there?
No. Mm-mm, just the two of us. And I never, well, you know, he was a big, lovable gay teddy bear too. So the minute I was introduced to him, I felt totally, you know, and he was this wonderful, warm, giving guy, which, you know, years later, I mean, he kept me, I was in his stable, you know, which was terrific.
But what's that mean?
He kept using me in his other, you know, movies. When he liked you and liked your work, he was really good, you know, good to you. You know, like a lot of, you know, like who am I thinking? Seth Rogen and all those guys. They always worked together. Well, he had his stable of people that he would always, his go-to people. And I became one of them and that was great. And so I called, I'll never forget. So I got home and he said, you got the part, you know, just right off the I go to. I was on my way to the Comedy Store because I had a show, an improv show that night, and no, he didn't call me. He told me at the apartment. I'm pretty sure, you know, I just have to check, blah blah blah. But I'm pretty sure you've got the part. So I go to the Comedy Store that night, and I was pretty sure I had it, but I wasn't sure. And there was a call backstage in the green room at the main room, and Robin Williams answered it. And he starts screaming, she got the part, she got the part, where's Susan Sager? And I about fell on the floor. I mean, everybody was all around me because that's what we always, Jimmy Bullock had just gotten a TV series and Sandra Bernhardt had just gotten the King of Comedy. You know, people were starting to, Sam Kinison was moving, you know, people were starting to really that place was becoming a launching pad. And so that was so cool. Robin Williams.
It's unbelievable.
Announced that I got the part. Yeah. And so I called my mom and my parents and I said, hey, I got my first movie. What? Yes, I did. What's the name of it? Eating Raul. Excuse me? Eating Raul. And what's your role, Susie? I play a dominatrix. Oh, that's very nice. So you got a Woody Allen movie, and I'm going to hang up now and call me back when that's the news.
Oh,
and she
hung
up on me. But my mom, that was her sense of humor. She always did. But no, my parents were just so supportive. And, you know, I mean,
well, that's nice.
And here we are, you know, okay, 30 years later, I'm doing autograph signings and all this stuff because this movie has longevity.
And it's a cult classic.
It's a cult classic. And one of the main reasons is, like, we were told, don't cut your hair, don't gain weight, don't. And then one day, Mary Warnoff shows up at the set and half her head was shaved. You know, she just kind of was doing a punk thing and whatever. But, you know, we managed to help her, you know, get it all covered up. And for $500,000, they shot this movie, and it made money right away. And then I was in New York City on the 35th anniversary, and there was a tribute to Paul Bartel, and that audience was packed.
Wow.
With Columbia students, NYU students, film students, how they wanted to know how we did it.
Okay, so I want to ask you more about the making of the movie. I mean, I've never really seen the movie all the way through, but I've seen scenes of it, and I've seen the trailer for it, and it's kind of like
I'm in the trailer.
It's kind of like, yeah, I know, I saw you. It's kind of a madcap comedy, and it reminds me a little bit of It's a Wild, Wild, Wild World. That's not the one. The one with the W.
A Mad, Mad World.
It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World, in terms of it's kind of slapstick, and there's like a lot of frying pan over the head humor, and a lot of big, broad comedy.
Right, right.
So how many days did you shoot?
I have no idea, because it was over a year.
Oh, I see.
And we did it on deferred payment, but, and so my first, I mean, I think what it worked, how they were able to work it through the union back then was, I think it was two actual weeks that they were able to string together as weeks, and, you know, not however we did.
In other words, they didn't have enough money to keep moving forward. They didn't have enough money to say, we have a 30-day production schedule. They just said, we're going to make a little bit of money and we're going to shoot this. Then we'll make a little bit more money and then shoot this.
And we were on call pretty much. And it wasn't until Buck Henry joined the cast that the money came in to finish it.
But I guess my question is, like, how do you keep continuity with that?
Well, I had gained a little bit of weight. They just had to shoot me an extreme close-up when we went back up for pickup shots and stuff. But, well, what I did, it was easy for me because my stuff was so out there.
Yeah.
You know, that...
Because you played, like, a blind man.
A blind nun.
A blind nun.
Yes.
And you were a border patrol inspector.
Right.
So why did they... Was that... I guess that was part of the joke.
Well, I was hired... He meets Doris at the swingers party, right? And I give him my card. And, when things happen, I don't want to, you know, give it away if you haven't seen it or people haven't seen it, but you should see it. It's pretty
funny. I will.
They contact me for help because they decide a swinger breaks in their apartment. They end up killing him with a frying pan, which is the only thing they have. And when they go through his pockets, he's got all this cash. And they realize, what? And they're trying to buy a country kitchen. They're this wholesome couple. They don't have sex. They sleep with little pillows. They're really kind of kinky and bizarre in their own way.
Yeah.
But it's opposite of what's going on in their building. And they just hate swingers and, you know, oh, they're trash and whatever. But I come over. They come to my house. And I'm feeding my baby chocolate chip cookies. And it's very normal.
You're a mom.
Yeah, I'm a mom. And but I say, like, you know, I draw the line at golden showers, you know, stuff like that while I'm, you know, shoving food in my baby's mouth. So it's, you know, it's always got this. There's a lot of nuance in it. There's a lot of, you know.
And it was cutting edge for sure at the time.
Oh, God, yes.
Totally cutting edge.
Totally cutting edge.
When did you read the script? When you were first in the apartment? Is that when you read the script?
That's when he gave me the script. He was just throwing sides at me because it was the day after I met his AD at the store. So there wasn't time, you know.
Did you do anything else young and stupid in Hollywood?
Oh, I did a lot of young and stupid stuff. You know, I worked at the Comedy Store. You know, there was a lot. It was wild up there.
I know. But I mean, so at the store during that time, you were a waitress for how long?
And then
you
Over a year.
Then you quit. And then you started going back just doing the classes.
No, I was doing the classes. Then I was performing there three nights a week.
But you couldn't be waitressing there. That's
no, but I wasn't
the other
waitressing.
Jobs.
Right. Yeah.
It's so funny. I don't think I realized how much improv was going on at the Comedy Store. I don't think I ever put that together.
Well, Mitzi got rid of it.
I
don't remember when exactly, but I think there was a falling out between she and Meg. And I was somebody Meg had brought in.
I see.
So that's kind of when. But I never felt any ill will because... You know, I mean, I always thanked her for the opportunity. I said, I never would have got this movie and, you know, what came after it if it hadn't been for working here. And I appreciated every minute I spent on that. So I loved it.
Yeah. Do you think that, because then I've had a lot of people on from the Comedy Store. Do you think it's haunted as well?
Oh, definitely.
You know, Pauly Short thinks it is not haunted.
Really?
He said to me, like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, he had no idea where I was coming from.
Pauly was kind of oblivious. Also, when he was a kid, you know, we used to all babysit for him.
Yeah, right.
Jack Perdue used to babysit for him. And he would come to our apartment. There was a bunch of us. We were all from Miami.
Right.
All either waitresses, bartenders, doormen, all that stuff. And if Jack had something he had to go do, like an audition, he'd drop Pauly off with us. So
and people raised him.
Everybody raised him. Yeah.
But it's just funny that he doesn't see any... And he doesn't... In other words, because the Comedy Store previously had been Ciro's, which was like a mobster hangout steakhouse. Uh-huh. And people said that people... You know, it's rumored that people were killed there.
Right.
Upstairs in those tiny little offices in the green room. And then people say it's still haunted by Sam Kinison and different people.
And Sam was a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a son named Sam. And last time I saw Sam... was right before the accident, like maybe a couple of months. And I could not convince him I was not naming my child after him.
I said,
he is named after Sam I Am, Sam Malone from Cheers, and Sam Simon, who created
The Simpsons,
who that's had a mad crush on. That's who my Sam is named after.
Did you know Sam Simon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very well. He was married to Jennifer...
Tilly. Yeah, exactly. My friend Tom knew him as well. Yeah, it's so tragic when you...
Oh, yeah.
You know, and cancer, I mean, obviously, you know, it's just so... Because you think, like, somebody has it all. You know, you think people are on top of the world.
Right.
And if you're sick, you don't have anything.
No.
Yeah.
No. But the thing about eating my role and playing a dominatrix, I've found some weird stuff on the internet, you know, about me.
Yeah.
Like, there was this guy from Albania, Ultimate Toe Sucker. Okay, you can't make that up.
No.
You can't. Who would think of it? And he posted Susan Sager from Eating Raoul, and he cut out all the comedy, and it looks like I'm a real dominatrix.
Oh, my God.
Well, my 17-year-old son happened to see it and reported it and had it taken up. It's like, that's my mom.
Oh, my gosh, that's so funny.
Yeah, that's the best thing, though, is having I have enough celluloid of myself to embarrass my children for the rest of their natural lives.
Wait, what do you mean celluloid?
You know, a film of me, know, like when Haley posts provocative pictures, you know, she wants to be an Instagram model.
Your daughter?
Yeah, my middle daughter. I go, Haley, you know, like, get a contract with Playboy or something. Don't give that away. Don't do that. She goes, well, you did it. Oh, my God.
Well, no, wait. This is very interesting because, you know, there is a difference between people who are making money as an influencer or whatever.
Right.
And so it is viable.
I go, it's a costume. It's not like I picked that shit out.
Well, she's saying the same thing, though, in a way, right? She's saying, I'm going to go on Instagram and do these poses or these looks. But it's not personal to anybody, right?
No.
Is that what she's saying?
I don't know. She just, that's her thing.
Does she look like you?
She's Chinese, so
Oh, this
no.
is your adopted daughter. Well, you have three kids. You have a boy, a girl, one.
And two daughters adopted from China.
Oh, they're both adopted.
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yes.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so they don't look anything like me. Although I did have black hair.
Yeah, yeah, you did have dark hair. I saw pictures
my
of
whole
that.
Life. You can still see it through the...
And so then this comedy thing like really took off for you.
What comedy?
Stand up. I mean,
well, I didn't start till I was 53.
No kidding.
Yeah, so that's not young and dumb if you want to stay on topic. But yeah, that was old and wise.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, because what happens, I feel like, with stand up, because I just finally started doing stand up again a couple of months ago after like a 15-year break, is that, you know, that my confidence level is a whole different place. And now I can kind of deconstruct comedy as to, well, it's funny or it's not funny. It's not right. It's not nearly as personal as I used to take it.
And that was before you had kids, right?
Yeah.
It's a whole different element that it adds, because it just is. It's a whole... And for me, it's like when I was young, I was trying to grab, you know, the big brass ring. Yeah. I wanted to do three camera live. And
sitcom was now four camera, or it was three right. And then four or whatever.
Yeah, but okay. It was back in the day, it was three camera live. And I ended up doing movies, you know, which poor me, boo-hoo. But yeah, I loved the medium of comedy.
But what are you saying? Like, you just don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's going
to
happen.
And what stand-up does is it allows you to take a little bit of control, because you can either go up or you don't go up.
Well, here's the thing. Acting is very addicting. I just shot something in Tonopah, Nevada. Have you ever heard of Tonopah?
Tonopah.
Nevada?
Yeah, isn't that...
it's one of the most haunted cities
isn't that an Allman Brothers song? I've been from Tucson yes. to Tucumcari, to Hatchape, to Tonopah.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
I've driven every kind of rig that's ever been made.
It's in like Death Valley. There's
wow.
nothing around it. But why, I don't know why I brought it up. I
because
forgot.
You
started singing.
There. Well,
and
no,
I was,
you were shooting
memories.
Something there.
Yeah, but I don't know why.
You
I
were
went
shooting
there.
In Tonopah, and you were just saying, like, you know, you came out to be an actor. Or you came out to be an actress,
yeah.
and you're doing stand-up. And when you're an actress, you have to depend on
yeah.
so many other people. You have
right.
To,
and,
so
but it's addicting.
It
acting
is
totally addicting.
It's so much fun.
It is so much fun. And to get to work, I got to really work on a character. I, like, walked around the town. I found out where I lived. Because I had some lines. I played a 60-year-old hooker, which I had to make that okay.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to come from a place of abuse. I wanted it to come from a place of power, because it was better for the character if it did. And it took me a while, you
yeah.
know, and walking around the town, and one of the lines I go, I'm the goddamn goddess of Tonopah. And this is like a godforsaken old mining town. A bunch
That's
of people died
awesome.
There. It's in
yeah.
the middle of nowhere. So I'm walking around this town, you know, and I go up to the top of a hill and I look out and I got it. It was the most
yeah.
gorgeous view. And I went, I'm the God damn, I just screamed it. I mean, nobody's there.
And so. Then you are.
It was. But with stand-up, my point was, that was a long way around the block. But with stand-up, I can think of something that afternoon, jot it down, go over it, and put it on stage that night. It's
right.
instant gratification. It's
right.
instant.
And if you fail, you fail. And if you don't fail, you win. So
and
it's
who cares?
Very independent.
Yeah, it's all a win if you do it. If you get up and do it and find out,
it
then
is.
It's a win.
I feel so much less... I remember when I did comedy when I first got out here, I would be like thinking about jokes for just so long, tearing it apart, what
right.
happened, what went wrong, why didn't they laugh, thinking it was all about me rather than projecting out to the audience and figuring out, to begin with, what their mood is and who
right.
is your audience
right.
and are they responsive
right.
and can you even go forward and commit to an act if they're not on board.
Right.
So if they're not on board or something just happened in the bar, you can't just go off on your own path. You have to be with them. You have to go to their level and then pull them up to where you're at.
Yeah, I just have to say kudos to you. I've been looking through this book called She's So Funny, and I've seen some quotes from you in there.
Oh,
from,
really?
Yeah, all the funny women. I don't know when it was done.
Yeah,
but
of the funny, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
yeah,
well,
yeah.
That's nice. Yeah.
So, yeah,
it's
from your stand-up. Yeah.
It's been a while, but now I'm really excited about getting back to it, because it's just, you know, all the things we just said. But the thing with acting is,
yeah.
is it is so addictive because it is so fun. They say that the only person on set that really does want to be there are the actors. Everybody else is ready to go home. But actors, they want to be there.
I don't know. The director, I worked with a great director this last time. It's my first NDA. I am 64 years old, and it's my first time ever signing an NDA for a project.
A non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because of a product?
Of some of the people that are in it
okay.
were former stars, child stars, Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
And then something's happening over there that this, I think, is being, you know,
and
released
around
that time.
And this is the one that shot in Tonopah.
In Tonopah. Yeah.
How interesting. Well, that's the thing, Susan. You give me a lot of inspiration in that. You just never know what's going to happen.
You don't know.
It's all a game of stick-to-itiveness.
Right. And it was just like when I walked in Paul Martel's apartment, you know, being young and stupid, you know, and there were plenty of young and stupid things I did. We all do. You know,
yeah.
we drink too much. We do too much
yeah.
drugs. We end up with people we shouldn't end up. I remember one time, this is really young and stupid, I ended up at the West Hollywood Clinic.
Yeah.
With a really good friend of mine, because I had slept with a drug dealer from Miami the night before, and I was convinced I had gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Convinced.
Interesting.
So I went to the, you know, the clinic to make sure I didn't. I mean, you know, because that night I didn't care. Ah, he got a tattoo. We did Quaaludes. And the next day I'm like, what did I do?
Yeah, it's tough, man. I see my daughter growing up and I don't want her to be young and stupid, but I know she has to go through some things on her own, but I want it to be in a very controlled fashion.
It's not going to be. It wasn't for you.
It is under my watch.
No, but it you know, it's like, oh God, you know, when I think about the stuff I did and I'm still like my son used to say, oh, come on, mom, you know you were a hippie, you smoke weed. I go, I've done everything but kill a man, okay? I'm just not going to tell you about it.
And you could have killed a man in Tonopah. Nobody would even know.
No, nobody would know.
You are so funny. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Because I've known you for a while now, but we never really talked. So this has been nice.
Yes.
You know? And you guys, check out Susan Sager again on Twitter and also on Instagram, at Susan Sager. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. And especially for supporting my sponsors. Really, you guys, when you support my sponsors, then you are supporting me and Alabama. Hooray! And one more time, on behalf of the very talented Susan Sager, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. Super fun.
I'm going to go watch Eating Raul. Today. My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week. If you're looking for heaven, baby, the light points to the rear, and you can't.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.